On our Earth, before writing was invented, before the printing press was invented, poetry flourished. That's why we know that poetry is like bread. It should be shared by all, by scholars and by peasants, by all our vast, incredible, extraordinary family of humanity. That was Pablo Neruda, and I'm Bob Holman, and this is the Poetry is Bread podcast, where poetry challenges us, makes us think, and with imagination and courage, changes the world. Very honored to have here in the Poe studio, Cecilia Vicuña, languages Selknam, Mapuche, Quechua Aymara, Kakan, Guarani, English, Greek, a bit of Italian, certainly Latin, Javanese, and Spanish.
Quizá alango. A word moves a bit of air, says Nachman of Bratislav. God is the essence of the written letters concealed in the dust of the poet's pencil, says the Sumana Santaka. To read a text in Thai is tivotak, to smash it into pieces. The yil, a song, is the only material manifestation of the invisible reality, the Mapuche say. A song melts the boundaries between the worlds, Lawrence Sullivan says. A vibratory disorder, an incantation, bends time itself. An image, too, is an interference pattern, a rhythm born at the meeting point of light and eye. We don't see light, we see with the light, someone says. A word in the air lets you hear the image, see the sound. In the Andes, people say an image hears, a sound sees. You don't put a mask to be seen, but to see with different eyes. But there's no word for beauty. A song must never strike a right tone. You say quizá instead. The slow power to transform. El suave endulzar de una fruta secándose al sol. A slow drying fruit. Hate and anger becoming peace and love. The spectrum at work. A color gradation is an effort of light to unite shadow and light. The rainbow has a motor, they say. To weave gradations is to weave an illusion, a destello that hits the eye. Not to mystify with illusion, but to clarify the role of illusion in our perception of reality. Alango in Java, beauty. Is not a noun, but a god, a divine manifestation. Simultaneamente arrobado y arrobante, being in ecstasy creates the state, quizá alango.
Well, there's no noun for beautiful, so I'm not going to say that word. But I'm thinking, you know, your performances are so directed at the audience, so physical. I mean, I'm just going to give our listening audience just one little taste, which is that one time I was sitting next to Cecilia at a Cecilia poetry reading, and she was talking to me, and I didn't realize it, but that was the start of the performance. Next thing I knew, our conversation, which of course was multilingual, was getting a little bit louder, and she was standing up, and suddenly she was behind the audience, and they didn't know. They were still looking for somebody up front, and all of a sudden there was sound, there it was, and then there was this red thread that was coming around. Anyway, I won't go on, because I want to ask you, Cecilia, when you're doing this into a microphone with a spit screen or whatever they call this thing in front of us, do you sense the audience? How does that work?
Well, I think it's an animal thing. The first time I found myself in front of an audience, it was 5,000 people that had gathered at the Museo Nacional de Bellas Artes in Santiago. I was probably 20, 21, and I was there with my tribuno, a group that I had somehow baptized and in a way invented, because suddenly I decided we're the tribuno, the no tribe, because we are not a tribe. And so what are we? We are the living no. And when I found myself in front of this rowdy audience, I felt it as if it was one creature, one alive creature, you know, like with a zillion heads and, you know, very, very, very chaotic. And I loved that. So I began to sing to that animal. Mm. And the animal danced to it right away. Mm.
Well, I certainly can envision our audience dancing, or at least getting their ear a little closer to have the words start to dance with their eustachian tube, with the hammer, anvil, and stirrup in the eardrum it beats upon, as you read that incredible poem, the tribuno. So in other words, what you're saying, which means no tribe, and that was the name you gave to your cadre, your posse, back in the day in Chile, a revolutionary force. You're telling me that your first reading was for 5,000 people.
Yes, that's the way it was. And so we were invited to be part of this event. That if this was in 1970, it was the summer of 1970, and so it may have been January. I don't remember the month, but I remember it was hot. And so it's Chile, so it's the southern hemisphere.
Right, right.
And it was the time of the happenings. So this was conceived as a happening that could have Baroque music and Mapuche music. Mm. And an uncle of mine that was a scientist who invented a machine called El Abstractoscopio Cromático, which was a machine that was perpetually creating huge abstract paintings projected on the wall. So it was also rock and roll. And Mapuche Trutrucas Mapuche is Trutruca. It's a sort of huge trumpet that is like the animal cry of an animal from another dimension.
So it sounds like Woodstock with a political depth to it. It sounds like, you know, it sounds like what the 60s into the 70s were about for us, you know, and the idea that politics, revolutionary politics, and art could be on the same stage, in fact, be in the same person, was just part of the crazed ambiance of Make It New that was going on at that moment.
Yeah, it was really poetry and life, art and politics all into one. And we experienced that, and now each time I tell any story from that period, the young people of Chile, who have been born so many decades after that, don't really believe that that can be true, you know, because after the military coup, all that completely disappeared. There was such a violent persecution of beauty, intelligence, creativity, and persecution. They, for example, targeted the balls of young boys and the vaginas of young girls, electrocuting them. And they did this to thousands and thousands of people. And so I don't think Chile has yet recovered from that, even though this year is 50 years from that military coup.
And so there was this extraordinary moment, the beginning of your poetry, quote, career, unquote, perhaps. And what happened next?
Well, a huge censorship came on towards me and towards people such as me. And so, for example, just before leaving Chile, I left Chile at the end of 1972 with a grant to study in London, to study art in London. So when I left Chile, I remember I was still in Santiago in my bedroom, my teenage bedroom, and suddenly there was a knock on the door, and it was my mother disguised as a journalist. And she said, I am here to interview you to see how you feel about living for London. And she had a recorder in her hand to record me. And when my mother did that performative act a few minutes before we left for the airport, for me it was like the sky and the heavens opened up and I saw a different reality. And I felt as if a huge earthquake had taken place and the whole reality that I knew as Chile had disappeared. And I remember at the time, this was so long ago, that an airplane that left Chile first had to land in Buenos Aires and then had to land in Dakar in Africa to refuel. And when I saw that that Chile that I had known was going to be gone, I arrived in Africa still crying. I cried and cried, sensing that a terrible pain was forthcoming, and it was. The coup was a year after that.
Wow. So your upbringing, am I right that I read someplace that you say your heritage is both indigenous, and I'd like to know what that means to you, indigenous, but also Basque is the language of the Pyrenees, that is a language isolate, no language is connected with it, such an unusual culture to be mixed, but is that true?
Yes, it is literally true in my blood. For example, the Basque are also the people where, is the only people that I know of where the Rh negative group is predominant. And that is true of my family and it's true of me. I am Rh negative. So it's undeniable. Plus, I did my DNA. And the Basques, of course, like everybody else, came from Africa, but via Ireland. So my genetic trajectory passes through Ireland. So I consider myself Irish Basque on my father line.
Wow.
But on the indigenous side, it's a very good question. What does that mean? Because my mother never knew that she was indigenous, nor did my grandma. But when I did my DNA, the DNA traced our family trajectory from Africa, Siberia, to the north of Chile. And this makes a lot of sense because my great-grandmothers were all born in the north of Chile. And they carried the name of one of the conquerors. And it was typical that the conquerors who raped, let's say, 1,000 women, all those 1,000 women would carry his name. So certain names are prevalent in certain areas because of the fucking of these monsters, you know.
Yeah.
But it is a language, the Tiakita. It is a language that was, and it's still regarded as extinguished. Even though the Tiakita people were not extinguished, they mixed. So I think of these people as my most, or my closest relatives from a past going back two or three centuries. But the language did not reach me. And I suppose that that's the reason why I sing in unknown languages, because I feel those languages in me as I don't create them, I hear them. Mm. And what comes out of my mouth is the longing for those sounds, those funny conversations that I hear in a language that we don't know.
I'm just sort of stopped here. Oh yes, I'm looking at the Arte Precario installation that you did. I'm going to just skip around a little bit. We're going to leave you on the way from Dakar to London chronologically, but as far as your art goes, I would like to first pick up on what you said by talking about these installations which you did, and I believe what was this in Chile where you were doing the Arte Precario. You did them in the streets, in nature, in nature's city streets. You created, you said, as listening to an ancient silence longing to be heard.
Yeah, that is true, you know. So what did it mean for me to be indigenous? I decided that I was indigenous when I was old enough to read in my father's library, and which was maybe when I was 3 or 4 years old. And my father called me my little Eskimo. Mm. And if you look at the pictures of Cecilia, I really looked Eskimo. And he gave me a little book that was called like that. And I could see the drawing in the book, and I could see myself, and I certainly looked that way. And then I saw Selknam Girl one day in a book. I was probably 8 years old or 7 years old at the time, super young. And I could see that she looked exactly like me. So I had decided that also when we were taken to the cinema to see cowboy films, I could never side with the cowboys, you see. So my way was completely sort of oblique and through my heart, not through my knowledge.
So you mentioned Selknam, which in the movie that I made, the little movie, it was 50 different languages in a 15-minute poem film. You speak Selknam, which I've always listed as a language. They call it sleeping now, but extinct is what we were using at the time, where you say Orishin, Orishin, Yipen, Yipen. So Selknam is from the south of Chile, am I right?
From Tierra del Fuego. It's a wonderful, extraordinary story of the Selknam people, that they arrived walking in this island when the island was still connected to the continent. And then the Magallanes Strait came up, huge strait, you know, huge branch of the very wild sea, and they were isolated. So they lived for 8,000 years in complete isolation. So they developed this extraordinary metaphysical universe of poetry and creativity. And then, of course, the white people arrived and they killed them like if they were not human beings. It was really monstrous. And I remember I was a teenager when it was published in the newspaper that the last Selknam had died. And so I grew up believing that they had gone extinct, but still some of their poetry had been collected, and I heard that poetry. And that's how I heard the voice of the women shamans saying those words. And I began to sing them in homage to those last women singers. But all that has changed because the grandchildren of the people that were determined to be extinguished by the white people, the colonizers, are saying, we're not extinct, we are alive, mm-hmm. and we're bringing now back the language. And I have met them, and it's really extraordinary to see women, Selknam poets, now singing and
chanting again in the language that is coming back.
That's so exciting. That's exactly, you know, we have laws to protect endangered species of plants and animals, but who's there to protect the languages? But now it seems that the people themselves of this culture realize their identity is within the words, within the languages. And when we were putting together that film, you told me that the last speaker that was known was named Lola Kiepya.
Yeah.
Did I say that right?
Yeah, you said it right. Yeah. That's right.
And I just wanted her name in because part of the orality is to keep these names alive, is to mention who done it and who did it. You know, the same time that the Selk'nam was going on in Tierra del Fuego, there was also a culture that this has just recently been discovered, uncovered, which is called the Karal Supe, which was up north. And am I right? This is...
Peru.
In Peru.
Yeah.
And they supposedly were unique in that they had no art, but they had kipas.
Kipu.
Kipu.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. The kipu that was found in Karal is... It has been dated in 5,000 years ago. So that would make kipu even older than written language as evolved in Mesopotamia. And to me, this is the most wonderful thing in the world, because if a kipu was found in Karal, already, you know, composed as a kipu, it means it evolved slowly from way back before that, you know. You can't come up with a kipu from one minute to the next. It's a very complex concept. You know?
So I guess it's time to let many of the people in the audience in on what kipu is, in that it's such a historical artifact is used in the extraordinary contemporary work of one Cecilia Vicuña.
Yeah, kipu means knot in Quechua. And the Quechua people are a later people in the Andes. And somehow they inherited the tradition of tying knots that pre-existed the Inca culture by a few thousand years, the Wari people 2,000 years before, and had already evolved kipu to a very complex condition. And it means that you encode information in the form of knots. Instead of writing, you write with knots. And the knots can carry as much meaning as alphabetic writing, as it has been studied, because the colors, the shape of the knot, whether it's spun to the right or to the left, the position of the knot, how many turns the knot has, all of it carries as many iterations as alphabetic writing. So it's a very complex system of information, plus it's tactile. And it has also a metaphysical dimension in that kipu was not just an object as you find in Wikipedia to keep count. Yes, you can also keep count. It also kept stories, but it also represents an umbilical connection with the cosmos. And this was manifested in ritual systems of ceremonies that existed. And to me, that is the most amazing legacy of the kipu, not the object, but the fact that it exists in so many dimensions.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. And of course, whoops, I'm not allowed to say beautiful anymore. Or maybe I should just say Oshin, Oshin. Which means beautiful, beautiful. And then yipen, yipen, which means disgusting, awful.
Both, both.
True poetry, yeah, containing both. Yes, so let's just skip right ahead here with the kipus. You just had a show at the Tate in London where your kipus were set free to have the meanings as people walked amongst them.
Yeah, the truth of the matter is that when I was growing up, And nobody even spoke about Khipu. It was so forgotten that only a handful of archaeologists and scholars knew about it. And somehow the teenage Cecilia found a Khipu in a book. And my impression is that Khipu decided that I belong in its sphere, in its field of perception or sensitivity. I don't know how to call it in Western terms. But the fact is that I was sort of, I am seeing here in your studio, you have a sort of tornado image. And that's how it felt, like the Khipu grabbed me like that and enveloped me completely in its universe. And I began creating Khipus first in my poetry. I began speaking of my own body as the legs being hanging knots, you know. And this is in the 60s. And then in the 70s, I began creating these little sculptures that were Khipus. And also in the year 1972, I created the first big Khipu that was the size of my room. I did that in Concon, Chile. And so you fast forward to 2022, when the Tate invites me to do the Turbine Hall. And if people haven't heard of the Turbine Hall, I believe it's the largest art space in Europe. I don't know if in the world, but at least in Europe. It's a huge space. And they invite me to do a piece there. And I look up and I see a Khipu. And I say, yes, I can do this. And I did actually two Khipus. And I call them Brain Forest Khipu.
Brain Forest Khipu. Por qué?
Yeah, because I think the earth itself is like a brain forest composed of the mycelium of mushrooms and the web of life that unites all forests in the world, because the forests of the world are creating the moist air that allows us to exist as human beings here. And as you well know, the violence against the forest of the world really began in Mesopotamia. And since then, Western culture, as it spread and colonized the planet, keeps destroying all the forest, which is suicidal for humanity. Because, of course, the earth will continue to exist, but probably without us. Because without the forest, it will be so dry and hot that human civilization will not really be possible. So I created this brain forest Khipu for people to sense the pain of the forest, the skeletons of the dead trees, and the music of the people that is dying along with the forest, because all forests have forest peoples, and these peoples have created some of the most beautiful poetry and music of the world. And so you entered into these Khipus at the Tate, and there was this amazing Khipu of sound, of, you know, the most beautiful music that nobody ever hears, because just like people don't hear the languages of the people that are being exterminated by colonization, they also don't hear the music. And I could see young babies going directly into a trance the minute they heard that, you know. I could see people of all races, all colors, old, invalid, young, crazy, all the people that enter by the thousands into the Tate, falling into a different state of mind just in the presence of these skeletons of the dead trees.
The Khipus. From rainforest to brain forest.
Yeah.
You bring us through, you humanize it with a single letter.
Yeah, because truly, our brain is so dependent on that moisture, you know. Our eyes could not see without their moisture. Our tongue could not speak without that saliva. You know, one of my books is called Spit Temple, and it's the notion that all this moisture, this humidity, is the most sacred thing, and that's exactly what we're attacking.
Spit Temple is a collection of your performances, and it's like everything you do. But what are you, a pole film artist? I don't, you know, because you're a poet, you're a filmmaker, you're a visual artist. Do you care how people, a multidisciplinary artist and so heavy and academic, do you have a preference for what people should call what you do?
Well, I think of myself as a poet because that's my primary occupation in this planet. And everything to me comes through poetry. And the fact that sometimes it becomes art is like a consequence of poetry. And if it sometimes becomes a performance or a film, it's always a consequence of poetry, because poetry, as you said in the beginning, is like air. Mm. We cannot exist without it. And if we acknowledge its existence, she takes us up, you know, and we become like an old expression, her charges, you know. It's like, that's how I feel, like if you let go of all these notions that are imposed on us, like you have a name, like you're a person, like you are this color or that color. If you let go of all that, you're just human. This humanness is completely poetical.
Language is the essence of being human, and poetry is the essence of language.
Yep.
Here we are. I'm looking over at the art that you looked at. It's got these marvelous cyclones that are drawn by Jean Heistein. And then it's got the words as printed by Lawrence Weiner, this kind of quick poem. It's a poem like you could catch as catch can, it says there.
That's what poetry does. Poetry sees someone passing and sees that this person is prone to cyclones and grabs them up. That's how I feel.
Well, what about Concon?
Well, Concon, it's my parents. You know, my parents had a love for this place. So I started to visit this place in my mother's tummy when I still didn't show up as a person. And so there are images of Cecilia, you know, in Spanish we say chapoteando, meaning your patitas, your little legs are splashing in this cold sea of the Southern Pacific. And I am a baby of not even 2 years old, and I am in Concon. So my family never lived all year round in Concon, but somehow the family always found itself in Concon. And it was in Concon that I suddenly felt like very much like that image of the cyclone. I felt the cold wind around my waist, being half naked as a teenage girl, bathing in the sea. And I understood suddenly from the way that wind caressed me that the wind was sensing and feeling me the way I felt it. And that changed everything for me. That's the moment when I sort of, in Spanish we say, me desaparecí. I wasn't what I was before that. To become like a leaf, like a piece of basurita, like a debris, like not even a grain of sand, but completely in awe of the beauty of this universe, you know, this wind, this light, this sea, this sand. And that's when my Arte Precario began. It's really an offering. It's a way of saying, I see that you see. And because we're seen, we're read, we're perceived by the world around us. And this pretense that it is we who see and sense is what's killing everything, because it ain't that way.
You know, people could say that you made a movie of Con Con, but hearing you talk, I know that it was an offering to Con Con rather than a description of, or, you know, that it was giving back. But it came in the form of a film. I wonder if that's a good enough segue to have you talk about poetry, film, and performance, and your film, Con Con.
Yeah, I think it is, because why would that become a film? It was, by the time I did the film, which I started doing it, it was, I think, the year 2006 when I began filming Con Con. I had been doing my offerings in that beach since 66, so how many decades that was. And through those years, the work that I did was completely invisible. It was visible to the sea. It was visible to the earth. I knew that, and that was enough for me. But in the year 2006, I had met my partner, James O'Hearn. And when he heard me speak about this, and a few other friends, art historians, started to see that the way I related to this place needed to be known by Chileans. And so it happened of itself that this wonderful art historian, his name is José Nordenflicht, he said, let's go to Con Con and we shall record our conversations right there in the places where you have been doing your offerings for all these many decades. And that's how the film came about. And we were filming, revisiting those spots for 4 years. And I remember when was the premiere of the film, nobody wanted to see this film. So I talked to the Fishermen Union, and the Fishermen Union said, yes, you should show it here in the Fishermen, because the Fishermen appeared in the film, had supported me while I was doing it, in the sense that they were willing to be part of the film. But like a night before the premiere, so-called, at the Union of the Fishermen said to me, we cannot do it anymore, because the union has separated in two fighting groups.
Oh.
And if you go with one group, the others will attack you. And so they say, but there's one union that still is united, which is the union of the oil workers, because the Chilean government put a refinery, an oil refinery, in the most sacred spot in Con Con, the ancient indigenous cemetery, going back 6,000 years of human occupation, poop, right there, the oil refinery. So it was in the oil refinery that I premiered the film. The audience was probably like 20 people, mothers, children, and the union workers. And I remember seeing these, you know, tough men crying by the end of the film, and also the women. And they asked me, where is this Con Con? And they had lived in Con Con all their lives, because that's how colonization operates. All the beauty and the deep dimension of knowledge of the people of this place is invisible even to the inhabitants of Con Con. So that gave me the measure of how important to do a little film was, because people can watch a film and they are not so open to hear a poet or a poem.
So you get back at them by having the film be the poem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in a way, as we move into digital consciousness, that's what we do. You know, I mean, the poets are always at the forefront of making the art. And now, if you have to write a poem with a camera, let's do it. Let's get there. And of course, it is true that the oral tradition can be carried through in digital in a much more authentic way than it is when it's translated into books. Although with your books, you add visual illuminations, to whether it's paintings or whether it's the text itself that changes. You know, your circularity writing is so extraordinary. But all of this woven together creates a new kind of art. You know, I'm thinking now of Kurt Schwitters, who thought that everybody should make up their own name for whatever they did, that there was no such thing as art. There was only what everybody made and whatever, and he called his merits.
Yes, like commerce.
Exactly. That's supposedly the story. He was doing his tearing of the newspapers, and there was Commercial, and he just tore the M-E-R-Z out of it and became the Mertz poet.
Yeah, and it is very true. And, you know, I was a little girl, but my family was a very educated family, and they had art books. And I remember seeing the Mertz Bau probably when I was in my early 20s or late teens, you know, and I saw that, and he was doing that in his own house. And I had seen my grandmothers, my aunts, my cousins, all of them worked in their bedrooms, and so did I, you know, so it made so much sense to me. And by the time I saw his Mertz Bau, I had already converted my bedroom in art, but it was one thing to do it in your own bedroom and to see it in a book, you see. So that sort of leaped my imagination onto, so this is a fantastic way of existing. That's what he communicated to me, you know.
A kind of validation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was it about that time that you sent your poems off to El Cornu Emplumado?
Yeah, I could say so. I was 18. I don't think I was yet 18 when I discovered, because I was a reader. I was always a reader. My father had a fantastic library. My grandfather published Vicente Huidobro, and he was also the lawyer of Pablo Neruda. So my family had, my grandfather was also friends with Gabriela Mistral. So poetry was part of the family life. And so one day I discovered El Corno Emplumado in a bookstore, and I immediately thought it was the most wonderful magazine in the world. And I sent my poems, and lo and behold, they took them in. And suddenly my poetry, I was only 18 by the time these poems came up there. And, you know, they would publish Allen Ginsberg, they would publish Thomas Merton, Ernesto Cardenal, Julio Cortázar. I mean, amazing poetry from all over the world. And suddenly, Cecilia, that was my first publication of poetry.
Wow. You know? And got to mention another name here, Margaret Randall.
Yes, she was the co-editor.
Oh,
you know,
my goodness.
Tremendous lady, and Sergio Mondragon, her partner at the time.
Right.
So it was a meeting point of the universes, the universe that Margaret brought in, the poetry, the beat poetry, and the universe that Sergio brought in.
Exactly. Yeah, a meeting of languages, a meeting of poets of the universe.
Yeah.
And El Corno Emplumado, which means the feathered horn. I always thought of it as a bull's horn, but later on, Margaret told me, no, are you kidding me, Bob? It's a saxophone or a trumpet. It's jazz.
It's the trumpet of the angels of William Blake.
Oh, that's what it is. She told me it was a jazz trumpet.
It's true. It's also jazz trumpet. It's both. You see, so the angels are really William Blake angels too, you know.
And the feathers come from Quetzalcoatl.
Exactly, yeah. So it's the Aztec Jazz Blake.
Ah, the Aztec Jazz Blake. And Margaret, hello to you out there in Albuquerque.
Yeah,
we're so
I
glad.
Really admire Margaret immensely.
True hero.
And can you imagine the mind that Margaret and Sergio had to put in a magazine a little girl like me along with this poets, and they did that all the time, not just with me, with other people. And we created a sort of community of friendship that is still alive today. You know, for example, when I arrive in London, it was in the year 72. Suddenly, through this network of poetry, Felipe Ehrenberg, who had been part of El Corno, heard that Cecilia was in London, and he immediately invited me to come publish a book with him, and that's how I published my first book. It was in London, because getting back to the censorship in Chile, I had signed a contract of my poetry in Chile in the year 71 before I left, and that book was never published, because even after signing a contract, the poems themselves fell into the hands of high-powered people in that university, which was the Catholic University of Chile, and they prevented the publication. And so
they were censored, and what was as I remember, it wasn't necessarily political censorship. It was
the censorship of a young woman, erotic.
There it is. Yeah.
Because erotic poetry written by women is more dangerous than any political.
Agreed. Yes.
And they succeeded in preventing that poetry from circulating in Chile for like 4 decades. You know?
Crazy, crazy, crazy. But you went on to do political work while you were in London there in the early 70s.
No, I actually began doing political work in Chile. Because I was part of the student movement that went for Salvador Allende.
Yeah, excuse me, I thought I meant that you continued your political work in
It
in
changed
London.
Meaning, of course, because when I was a teenager, the great movement that took Salvador Allende to the presidency, we kids in the high schools also participated. And we rallied along with the miners and with the peasants and with the workers. It was like a different world, the Chile before the coup. And so for example, my first exhibition was an homage to the construction of socialism. And that was in 1971 in Santiago at the National Museum of Fine Arts. And my homage consisted in filling one room with autumn leaves. And how could that be political, everybody asked. And I said, well, because the leaves are dying. And if you're aware of your death, you have to fight for revolution, because you're going to die so soon. So you have to fight for joy. And the only way to fight for joy is revolution. That was my logic as a young girl. I still believe in that logic, you know.
The only way to fight for joy is revolution. I'm just going to tattoo that on my hand right now. So I'll never forget that.
And the actual revolution of Allende was joyful. You know, we danced in the street. I remember there were rallies. At the time, Santiago was a small city of 3 million people. There were rallies when there was 1 million people dancing for joy in the streets, you know. And so how did that beauty bring about the horror of Nixon and Kissinger thinking we have to stop that freedom, we have to stop that joy, you know. And they did. And
I was in Nicaragua with the Sandinistas, with Ernesto Cardenal. I was in a trip with Allen Ginsberg, and Ernesto came out to the tarmac up onto the airplane, and it really did feel like utopia there with all the poetry workshops going on, and people had this dancing, joyful spirit.
So you felt it. You were part of that.
Listen, I felt it also in Eritrea. In the year 2000,
yes.
I've been very lucky to feel it twice, but in both cases, as in Chile, I mean, it doesn't last long.
Yeah.
You know,
it's not allowed, because the combination of patriarchy and capital, you know, has been deadly for the planet. And it's not allowed, because that is the true language of freedom, is the right to be ourselves. And that is what is not allowed, you know. And so it's a terrible thing because the language of freedom has been kidnapped by the ultra right around the world. And this language of lies, and it's a language of disguised hatred. And that is what rules the waves, you know. And when, I wonder, are people going to begin to turn away from that language of hatred and, you know, discrimination?
Wonder when. Well, certainly going to see your exhibition at the Guggenheim, which was called Spin, Spin, Trianguline, was a moment of liberation and joy.
Yes, and it's again like this cyclone, spin, spin, because spinning is the property of the cosmos, you know, and it's also the property of emergence, meaning how unexpected change occurs. And it is through this unexpected change that I believe we still have a chance to turn around the destruction. And it is through spinning, through not spinning as it is used in the U.S., like spinning a false tale.
Mm-hmm. But to put a spin on something.
Exactly. Yeah. But it is through allowing our blood to speak. That's a Maya concept, you know.
Let the blood speak. I also see it, Cecilia, as spinning thread, to come up with that red thread that you use to weave together an audience, or the thread that you use to have knots in it that have the meanings that we take alphabets to figure out in your kippah.
Yeah, and it's weaving together, you know, is to connect with our deep selves, to connect with the living spirit of what we now call nature. What a bad name, because what is not nature? You see, mm-hmm. Everything is nature, but truly everything that lives, and even minerals, bacteria, virus, the whole bit is miraculous, you know. And so for me, it is the act of total love is the awakening, you know. And poets have been saying this all along. It's not our generation, but it is certainly the one line, the one thread that unites all forms of poetry.
What would you think about trying a little performance right here, right now?
What would you like to do? Would you like to do what you thought of?
I would like to do what I thought of, yes. Precario.
Where is it? I found it.
Precario, which, okay. Of course, is precarious, but also in its root meaning, it goes back, I didn't know this, to prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy to think of those two words, how they are related.
Yeah, I call it precario, arte precario, thinking that precario meant fragile because it disappears.
Mm.
And I thought that is our condition as humans. We are here for a very short time and we will disappear. That is what makes us beautiful. That is what makes life majestic, the fact that it's only for a short time. And that was why I called it precario. And then, like 20 years later, I encountered the Latin. And the Latin says that precarius means obtained by prayer. And I thought, what a wonderful thing to think that our precarity, the fact that we are so fragile, is our way of praying. And prayer itself is so fragile. What is not fragile is the fact that this mystery goes on, you know. And even if we don't succeed in surviving as humanity, other creatures will go on. Bacteria will continue to colonize. And from that colonization, who knows what kind of life will come. And it's all precarious. Okay. So I will say one line and you will say the next.
I always love having a director.
Yes. ¿Y si yo dedicara mi vida?
And if I devoted my life.
A una de sus plumas.
To one of its feathers.
A vivir su naturaleza.
To living its nature.
Serla y comprenderla.
Being it, understanding it.
Hasta el fin.
Until the end.
Y llegar a una época.
Reaching a time.
En que mis gestos.
In which my acts.
Son las mil varillas.
Are the thousand.
Infimas.
Tiny ribs.
De la pluma.
Of the feather.
Y mi silencio.
And my silence.
Los zumbidos y susurros del viento en la pluma y mis pensamientos veloces ajustados. Certeros como los no pensamientos de la pluma,
the non-thoughts of the feather.
La pluma.
Thanks go out to our dear friend and wonderful guest today here at Poetry is Bread, Cecilia Vicuña. You know, folks, if you each got to make up your own art, would you please get busy and make up Cecilia Vicuña? I'm Bob Holman, and thank you for listening to Poetry is Bread. Subscribe to our podcast to get notifications of new episodes, or check us out at BoweryPoetry.com. Podcast is co-produced by Ram Devanini and Flavia Roja with Rataplax. Artwork by Fabian Ceruleo. The podcast series is funded by National Endowment for the Arts and New York State Council on the Arts, Governor of New York State, and the New York State Legislature. Cecilia, have you a last word or anything for us here?
Da 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 da